Love the On Story podcasts? Pick up a copy of the On Story book today for advice and inspiration from today's leading filmmakers. On Story, Screenwriters and Their Craft is a must-read for all screenwriters and film fans. Find it in Amazon or at AustinFilmFestival.com. And if you want more On Story, watch, listen, and read at OnStory.tv. And visit us for On Story panels live at the 21st Austin Film Festival and Conference this October. Get $25 off a Lone Star or Weekend badge with the code PODCAST at AustinFilmFestival.com. Don't forget to search Austin Film Festival in the iTunes Store to rate and review this program. And take our survey at survey.libsyn.com/austinfilm. That's all one word, survey.libsyn.com/austinfilm. 2 minutes or less will help us continue to bring you this great program. Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is presented by Final Draft, the industry standard number one selling screenwriting software in the world, with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. For more info, go to finaldraft.com. Today on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, Randall Wallace.
Writing a script, it's like raising a child, and there's a way in which you feel absolutely responsible for every tiny thing, and then other ways in which you think, I have nothing to do with who this person is.
In anticipation of the 21st Austin Film Festival and Conference this October 23rd through the 30th, we've prepared a series of episodes featuring returning panelists. Randall Wallace is the Oscar-nominated screenwriter behind such critical and box office hits as Braveheart, We Were Soldiers, Pearl Harbor, Secretariat, and Heaven Is For Real. Randall Wallace will be joining us for a special screening of Braveheart and two panels at the conference this year. Today's content was recorded on October 21st, 2010 at the 18th Austin Film Festival. Randall Wallace describes his background, screenwriting as a divine calling, and his path to creating the screenplay for Braveheart.
I grew up in Tennessee. My father's from Lizard Lick, Tennessee. The men in my father's family are Alton, Elton, Dalton, Lyman, Gleeman, Herman, Thurman, and Clyde. And they call Clyde Pete, and no one has any idea why. I don't know where y'all are from, but I don't think it could be more down to earth than Lizard Lick is. And I always thought it was so funny when I was trying to figure out how I was going to get anywhere and get anybody to read anything. And I felt there was this enormous gulf between where I was and where they were. When I was in college, I think I might have actually even been in graduate school. I went to Duke Divinity School. One of my professors said to me, if you want to be a lawyer, I can show you the bottom rung of the ladder. And when you can get a hold of that bottom rung, if you can pull yourself up, the next rung will be within your reach. And that's how you climb the ladder and become a lawyer. You want to be a doctor, I can show you that ladder. But to be a writer, I don't know where that ladder is. But there is one. And it's more like the metaphor of you have to drop into the deep, dark woods and you're lost. When you're in the woods for a while, then you become expert in woodscraft. You learn where to find water. You learn how to build a fire. You learn where to find shelter. You learn who's dangerous and who's not. And you're following instincts. And it's more like that. I think that writing a script, it's like raising a child. And there's a way in which you feel absolutely responsible for every tiny thing. And then other ways in which you think, I have nothing to do with who this person is. They are completely independent. They have their own life. I obsess over every comma. But I find that in order to write, I have to let all of that go and just be. It's like playing with a child. You let them do what they're going to do. You watch them. You leave them alone, but they're never out of your heart. In Braveheart, I had written that totally without any. I actually picked Mel Gibson to be the star. I picked him as the person I wanted. I didn't make him do it. If I could have, I would have. I felt like my father felt on my sister's wedding day when he turned to me and said, she's got another shoulder to cry on now. It was one of the most beautiful moments for me, realizing how much my father loved my sister and that he was turning her over to another man to care for. That's the way I felt about any script that somebody else was going to direct. when I was writing it, I didn't feel in total control, but I felt that I had more responsibility then to be watching what was happening, to be making it work in a different way. And then when I was working with a script that someone else had written, I thought, it's so easy to start thinking that you made it up. When you're directing, every word the actor said, you have to believe is yours. And I've seen it happen many times when directors start to think they actually did write the scene, even though the scene is verbatim what the other guy wrote. But there's a process of ownership, and when it's best, when it's at its best, it's a union between the script and the direction. The ultimate thing about being a writer is to write words that are so economical and so focused to what you want to tell that they are not changeable. Braveheart felt to me verbatim. And it wasn't exactly verbatim, but it almost was. I know that Mel felt he reinvented every scene within himself. So there's that, almost like a mother and a father, you know, both of whom look at a child and believe they're totally manifest in that child. And the truth is that they needed each other to do it. I had married an Irish American woman, which was about like diving into a barrel of cobras. I always said if you threw her into a barrel of cobras, she would come out with a purse and a new belt. And she knew her family history because she had a Mormon ancestor, and they knew everything about where. And I was, you know, your basic Southerner, and I didn't know any of our family. I mean, we were just Americans. I didn't actually know until later that is characteristic of the Scots-Irish, that immediately getting off the boat, they all said, we're Americans. And that's why you didn't have hyphen. You don't hear, I'm Scottish American. They were cleared off their land. Many came as indentured servants. My family came to America in the 1660s. I don't know why we didn't buy real estate, you know. But I wanted to know what my family's heritage was in the context of being about to be a father. And we went to Edinburgh, Scotland, I just heard that Wallaces were from Scotland. And at that time, I had been a songwriter and had been so successful at that I decided to write screenplays. And I wasn't getting anywhere with anything. I'd sold a few things, and I'd had a couple of novels that had taken me a year to write each one, and I'd made like $5,000. So I would have qualified for, you know, welfare. But we were frugal, and we had saved our money, and we could buy the plane tickets. And we were in Edinburgh and walked into Edinburgh Castle, and there, flanking the doors, were two statues, William Wallace and Robert the Bruce. And I had never heard of William Wallace, but I'd heard of Robert the Bruce as the greatest king of Scotland. So if William Wallace is standing there with him, he must have been good. I asked, there's a member of the Black Watch Guards, and I don't know, does anyone in this room have a kilt? I will tell you, you put a kilt on and you become a bad motherfucker. You just go around, walk around, you look at guys going, what'd you say? You know, because you've got on a skirt, right? Only it's a kilt. Excuse my French, but that's how you feel. And this guy was standing there in a kilt, and I said, who is this William Wallace? And he said, he is our greatest hero. And I was an American, absolutely fascinated by history. And here's this man named Wallace, who is the greatest hero in his country. He's standing next to Robert the Bruce, and he's saying, William Wallace is the greatest hero. And I have never heard of him. And my name is Wallace. And that alone just made me think, what? And I, of course, I'm elbowing my pregnant wife going, greatest hero, honey, greatest hero, honey. So I said to the guy, so he must have been an ally of Robert the Bruce and fighting the English, because I knew that's what Robert the Bruce had done. And he said, no one will ever know for sure, which, by the way, those are the magic words to me of being a screenwriter. No one will ever know for sure. I love that. I want to make it up. I don't want to transcribe from a history book. Our legends say, which is another great screenwriting, you know, that's the hook in your mouth when you're a screenwriter, that Robert the Bruce may have been one of William Wallace's betrayers to clear the way for him to become king himself. And I nearly fell down. That's like being told that Judas Iscariot and St. Peter were the same individual. The man who betrayed the greatest hero, but then became the greatest king. What if something about the life and death of William Wallace was what transformed Robert the Bruce from being the kind of man who would betray a hero to be a great king himself? That felt like a magnificent question. And it was 10 years before I could sit down and write that story. My route was, I will not let two things stop me. One is fear of failure, and the other is lack of effort. Those two things will never stop me. That was my commitment. I didn't know if I had the talent, the luck, the whatever the combination of ingredients. So I started working. I ended up in television. I had a lot of money. Things were working really well. And then we had a writer strike, and the company I was working for was collapsing, and I had a huge mortgage, and I thought I was going to go bankrupt. And I had now two young sons, and I was so nervous I couldn't write. And I remembered my own father having a nervous breakdown when he was in the same situation when I was the same age as my oldest son. And I got down on my knees and I said to God, all that I really care about here is my sons. That's all that matters. Maybe the best thing for them is that they not grow up in a house with a swimming pool and German cars in the driveway. Maybe they need to live in a little house like I lived in growing up. One time in my life, I lived in a house with no indoor plumbing. My father said, rich people have a canopy over their beds and we got a canopy under our bed. But I got on my knees and I said, if that's what's best for my sons, then let me do that. But if I go down, let me go down with my flag flying. Let me write what I want to see. And I got up and I started writing a story called Love and Honor, which is a story that led me to Braveheart. C.S. Lewis said, if you write for the applause of the audience or the approval of the critics, you have no hope of writing anything worth reading. But if you write to tell the truth as you know it, then what you write will be worth reading. The executive who bought Braveheart, the one who, I told her the story, she's the daughter of Sidney Pollack. His daughter, Rebecca, was a studio executive. I told her in 10 minutes the story of William Wallace, and she went, go write that. I said, you want an outline? You want my treatment? She went, what, I'm going to tell you how to rewrite Act Two? Go write that. She believes in movie moments, that there are like definitive moments when the audience's love meter just snaps and goes, I'm with them. Whatever else happens, I'm with them. For me in Braveheart is probably when the girl brings him snaps off the thistle and gives him a flower at his father's grave. And then when he gives it back to her. I didn't know that was going to happen when I was writing it. That was not in an outline. It was not in any historical, you know, documents. I thought, if he goes back to this village, has he remembered anybody and why? And I thought maybe he would have remembered one of the girls. And I had them go out on a date, and here's this great warrior, and he can't talk to her. He doesn't know what to say to her. And they go out and riding, and she goes, well, why didn't he, if he wanted me to go riding with him, why doesn't he say something to me? And I'm writing this stuff, and I'm going, well, gosh, he needs to say something. You know, you're each character when you're writing, of course, and feel her going, well, why doesn't he say something? And I didn't have anything I could think for him to say. So she turns in disappointment to walk inside thinking, well, he doesn't really like me. And he catches her hand. I didn't know he was going to catch her hand until I wrote it. Maybe he gives her something. Maybe he brought something to give her. Maybe, and then he's kept the flower. I didn't know that was going to happen, but man, I like this guy. And I think women are going to like him too. During the testing of the movie, one of the key players in the process walked into the editing room, and I was sitting in there with Mel Gibson, and this guy said, listen, all this stuff you guys are putting in the movie about women aren't going to like this movie. This movie is for 14-year-old boys. And then we do the first test screening, and when they killed her, for the women in the audience, there was not enough that we could do to the English that was sufficient. The women wanted us to ride horses over their faces. They wanted, the women were the ones that wanted the retribution. And then in the final scene, the axe is dropping toward William Wallace's throat. I can see myself sitting in the room of my house. I was writing that the axe was falling toward his throat. I knew we wanted to see the axe fall, but I knew that we could not film the axe hitting his throat. That just wasn't ever going to be in the movie. And you know, it's really funny. I say I write from the point of view of each character, but ultimately I also write from the point of view of being an audience member. And the axe is dropping toward William Wallace's throat. I wrote that. And then I thought, what in the last fraction of a second of his life happens? And I thought, well, let's be with him. What would he do? And I thought, maybe he would turn and look for his friends. And I wrote, William Wallace, in the last fraction of a second of his life, turned his eyes to find his friends. And not until that moment did I know that she was between them.
See Randall Wallace at this year's Austin Film Festival and Conference, October 23rd through the 30th. Badges and passes on sale at austinfilmfestival.com. Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival, the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission of the Arts, and is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com.